It's been over 12 years since the first time Haroon Mogul was on this program. He's been back many times since then, increasingly as a successful author. Earlier this year, Haroon released his latest book entitled 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future, and it's among our favorites for 2022. Haroon, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I can't believe it's been 12 years.
You get a special medal that you have to wear every time you talk to the show. But we're thrilled. And also, congratulations on this book. Tell me why you felt like this was the book that you wanted to write right now.
So I had written a book called How to Be a Muslim, which was actually the story of how most of my life up till then I had tried and failed to be a certain kind of Muslim. So it was a little bit tongue in cheek. But not everybody got the joke. And many folks came to talks and picked up the book thinking it would be just that, a guide to being Muslim, which I thought was quite audacious for a book that's not that long. And it got me thinking that maybe I should actually write a book about what it means to be a Muslim. And so the initial idea was quite simple. It was just supposed to be a little introduction to Islam. And as I started writing, it transformed itself completely from who are Muslims in the past and maybe the present into who can Muslims be and who should Muslims be. So from a book that looked to what had come before to a book that was looking into what was coming ahead and how to prepare for it.
Amazing. And so the title is 2 Billion Caliphs. Can you say, explain to us what a caliph is, which not everybody might understand that reference?
So probably most people have heard the term, if they've heard the term, in reference to either historical caliphates, kind of like empires, dynasties, monarchies, that sort of thing. The Ottoman Empire was the probably the most formidable of those and probably the most well-known. And then in much more unfortunate circumstances, the ISIS iteration, which popped up before COVID and was quite brutal, but fortunately short-lived, although it did a tremendous amount of damage in the regions where it operated. And so the term, I think, was in currency in Muslim spaces as well as in public conversations. And I wanted to investigate the term. And the more I looked into the Islamic sources, specifically the Quran, actually the original iteration of caliphate, the first use of the term is as a word that describes Adam and Eve, and then in theory and in ambition, all of humanity, that every single person, or at least Muslims in this version, are caliphs, as in we are stewards or custodians of God's creation, that we have a special authority and a special responsibility and a certain kind of unique moral agency. And I wanted to dwell on that and stop focusing so much on hierarchical models of Muslimness that constantly try to slot us into certain positions vis-a-vis one another, with a few at the top and everyone else at the bottom just going along, into something that was more democratic, more organic, more local, and more resilient. And certainly I thought that was something we needed for the years and decades ahead.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, you know, this, you know, I come from the Baptist tradition, which right now there's like Baptists who call themselves bishops and all this kind of stuff. But the real like foundation of it is like really like radical priesthood of all believers and the soul freedom and the sense that every single person is able to have that full dignity of a full, like, you know, a full Christian, and that there's actually no one else that has that over them. And I think the idea that this is totally new to me, by the way, and thank you for writing this already, you know, this idea of the caliph is something that, you know, every Muslim can embody is just, I think, a very powerful idea, especially as we look around the country. You know, I'm thinking about Iran immediately, but this idea of like who gets to say for who another person what a Muslim is, and, you know, not to single out Islam, that happens in every tradition. You're not a Christian, you're not a Jew, you know, but I think, you know, right now we see that in so many places around the country, like certain people, the gatekeepers of what, you know, what counts as Muslim. I really appreciate that you're putting in that work. Like, so what did you uncover or, you know, discover? I like to say that for me, like, writing is revelation. Like, often, you know, when I have to preach or I have to do something and I start writing, I'm like, oh, I didn't even know I thought that. I'm wondering if you had that experience. Like, what did you uncover or what was revealed when you started writing this book about specifically about what counts as being a Muslim?
Well, so when I started writing the book, it was before COVID. And so we lived in a very different world, and certainly a very different world than what has transpired in the last year. And there's two events in specific I want to focus on. The first is a little bit more than a year ago, the fall of Kabul and the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. And then not so many months later, the Russian invasion, or I guess second invasion, depending on how you look at it, of Ukraine in February. So coming up on almost a year now. And I think those two events together, if you take them as bookends, they really mark the end of the post 9/11 era. That in the United States, pretty much across the board, Islam is no longer the bogeyman. There is certainly Islamophobia and there is bias against Muslims, but we are not in the public consciousness as the biggest problem. Some people will make that China, some people will make that Russia, some folks will make that the other political party, but certainly we're kind of lower down on the scale now. And what that meant to me was really for the first time, Muslim communities, certainly in the West, but perhaps more broadly, for the first time in two decades, we are free from a certain kind of weaponized binary that some Muslims advanced and some folks in the West advanced, that you're either on this side or that side. And so I asked myself, who are we going to be now? Who should we be? Who can we be? And that's where I went to the idea of caliphate, literally to get to what you're saying, this idea of the sort of that the priesthood of all believers kind of thing is not so dissimilar, is this idea that everyone is judged by God as an individual, and something I was always vexed by growing up. I came from a pretty religious family. America and I think maybe Canada are the most ethnically diverse Muslim nationalities in the world, which is kind of fascinating and kind of amazing. And you get these Muslims from all different backgrounds kind of thrown together by geography, economy, what have you, and suddenly they have to find a place to pray. And one family, I'd say, is coming from Senegal, one family is coming from Indiana, one family is coming from Pakistan, and they're all equally convinced that what they're doing is authentically Islam. And at, you know, at least outwardly, no one can judge and, you know, look into someone's heart, but outwardly, everyone is committed to this tradition, yet has very different ideas of what that means. And so that was one take on it. But the other was that people didn't want to yield their take because of this idea of universal individual accountability, that actually Islam is, contrary to how many people present it, including in Muslim spaces, you mentioned Iran, and Iran is a perfect case in point. It is a very individualistic religion in the sense that every human being, male, female, rich, poor, black, white, what have you, has to stand before God for judgment. And you can't really pass the buck. Of course, obviously, people have different levels of capacity in the world and different things to answer for. Certainly, if you have more power, you have more responsibility. But at the end of the day, we have choices and we have freedom, or we should have choice and we should have freedom. So that's really where this came from, this idea of, okay, now we can imagine a different kind of future. We have to imagine a different kind of future. And what is the role of faith in that future?
I think that is incredibly powerful. When you look, you know, I mean, obviously the Quran is, you know, is revelation. Like, are there areas in the Quran that you found as you were writing, like, I don't think that has quite been lifted, lifted up the way I'm seeing it right now. I mean, I'm curious if there's anything from the Holy Scripture, or I may be calling it wrong, but I think you all understand what I mean, is that sprang to life for you as you were writing this book that maybe you hadn't paid as much attention to before.
Well, certainly one thing did jump out is that many of the descriptions of the divine in the Islamic tradition tend to focus on otherness. And so, and this is common in the Abrahamic tradition. There are elements of this in Judaism and Christianity, certainly, of the divine as so different from us as to be somewhat incomprehensible, certainly different in terms of limitless, omniscient, omnipotent, not bound by time and space, perfectly coherent with itself, himself, however you want to frame it. And that the way I saw this translated in Muslim spaces created a sense of distance. And one thing that occurred to me as I was reading this is that certainly there is something to be said for that kind of distance, and we can mine that for days, weeks, months, what have you. But there is also a kind of interesting impact or a consequence of the distance, which is intimacy. Is that a divine that is completely independent of creation is the kind of divine that creation can always turn to. That unlike anything and everything else in existence, you know, no matter how much we want to do for, let's say, a spouse, a loved one, a child, a parent, a coworker, a friend, we can't always be there for them. It's simply impossible. And as we learned in COVID, no matter how wealthy or sophisticated our societies have become, we can be felled and slowed and stopped by things that are literally invisible to the naked eye. And so there is this sense that everything in the world is contingent, but the divine being necessary and self-sufficient is a kind of a rope to hold on to, a hand to hold on to. And so maybe one of the reasons for the distance is to enable intimacy. And it sounds counterintuitive that how can you be connected to something that is so radically different from us that we can't even really get our heads around it. But maybe that's the point, or at least part of the point.
No, I think the way you're describing it is really striking. It occurs to me, like, if you were sinking, you wouldn't want to send a rope that you were sending to yourself.
Yeah.
You'd want a rope that was sent by something completely different than you that you could hold on to and pull yourself out. You know what I mean? Like, so I think that this idea of radical, intimacy and radically different is actually really powerful. It makes me think that, like, I'm sure that this book, your audience probably was the Muslim community. But my guess is that, for many of us reading this book, it can be, we can have a better insight into a community, but also learn spiritual wisdom for ourselves.
Certainly. And I took a lot out of my engagement with other faith traditions. So
yeah.
Learning how Jewish scholars or Christian scholars or Buddhist scholars approach their tradition, I think opens up space for us intellectually, creatively, with compassion, to see things from different perspectives and maybe understand ideas in different ways. And I think that's something that all people of faith have to do, especially now, where I think the challenges that are ahead of us, they're not insurmountable, but they're pretty big. Things like climate change, certainly a lot of the instability we see in our politics, and even just the jumbling of humanity that we now live in. I've just been watching the World Cup, for example, and it is kind of remarkable that here we have arrived as a species at a point where we are literally bringing together many countries of the world. And that's not to say that everything's done right or everything's above board, but that's a level of interconnectedness and immediacy that a few generations ago we could have never imagined. And that's certainly a beautiful thing, but it's a challenging thing because it forces us up into each other's faces in a way that we never had to be before. And what are the moral, the spiritual, the human resources that allow us to survive that and not be manipulated through that to outcomes that are actually bad for us individually, never mind each other, as communities and countries.
Yeah, I mean, it actually, like, the proximity, it presents to us an immediate sort of like, okay, we can make this good or bad. You know, and it really is like, it's like almost that simple. Like, we can learn about one another and celebrate one another. We can, like, you know, we can make that a opportunity for a closer engagement and a mutual enrichment, or we can just decide to hate one another. And, like, you know, it almost is that simple. And the United States is like a really good example of that. And, like, that in motion. I'm curious, when you think about a vision of a Muslim future, let's take that really, like, you know, to our own country. And, like, what will look good to you as a Muslim and for the Muslim community and for America as a whole in, like, 25 years if we could somehow do this right? And I love, you know, what I love about what I'm hearing you is, like, there is a kind of a positive frame. And yet it's going to take work. But what would it look like? Like, what will a positive future look like? And then walk us through what we need to do to get there.
Sure. So, it's funny because this connects to a question I know you're going to ask me later, but there's a saying by, I believe it was Dwight Eisenhower, that every American has to have a religion, but I don't care which one it is. I'm sure I'm garbling that up. But effectively, what he was saying is that America as a democracy only functions if there are civil religions. And I think there's something to that. So after 9/11, there was a lot of conversation about whether Islam and the West were compatible. And I think these were often very superficial or zero-sum conversations. And where I stand now is I think that for the United States, we as a country, and actually the Islamic tradition, have certain similarities. And these are similarities that exist in a lot of traditions. So I don't mean by any means to say that this is simply exclusive to Islam as a faith tradition. It's just the faith tradition that I know well. But in the Islamic tradition, there is this idea of individual agency, which certainly you find in Christianity and Judaism and Sikhism and other faith traditions. And what that means is that ultimately, what Muslims are doing on a day-to-day basis is applying their moral reasoning and their circumstances and contexts and emotions and needs to sacred text. And we as Americans, obviously America is a political idea, it's not a religion, but we do something similar, that's what it means to be in a democracy. And we have to learn how to respect each other's rights to do that. Now, one thing I think as a Muslim makes this a little easier for us is that I've never really had a problem accepting that mainstream culture doesn't go my way. So for example, we've seen a lot of conversation in certain Christian spaces around losing America, quote unquote, that America is turning on Christianity. And I can't quite see it that way as a Muslim, principally because I've never imagined, just for demographic reasons, that America would really be a society that would follow my cultural or religious norms. So, as a very trite, silly example, it never bothered me when someone said Merry Christmas, because I just assumed that I live in a country where most people are Christian or culturally Christian. And so that's just what it is. And so I didn't get off Friday afternoon, but as long as I had a reasonable accommodation, I kind of didn't mind. And I think we're reaching a point as a country of pluralism where we're going to have to learn how to accept each other's rights, especially in the really awkward places where they bump up against each other. And I think part of that requires a shift. So in a lot of Muslim spaces, we have a lot of talk of responsibility, not a lot of talk of rights. So in Iran, for example, there's not a lot of talk about human rights from the governmental level, right? Certainly there's a lot of talk about responsibility, as in what the state will enforce and expect you to do. And I think in the US, we've gone too far in the other direction, that we have a lot of talk about rights, but we don't have a lot of talk about responsibility. And so if we look at the conversation around COVID, I'm not really sure how we became as a country. I don't remember anyone really up in arms over seatbelts, for example, right? No one, I don't really recall that anyone saw that as an unjust imposition on our freedom. It was just sort of a reasonable.
Oh, I think some people did, but it's a good example. I actually think people thought that was like, oh, the communists are coming to get us by.
So maybe we have communism in our
heart. So, but it's a perfect example.
And that's the thing, is I think that's that kind of, and that's a good point. So maybe these are the kind of things that fade over time and we get used to them and
right.
move on.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, your point is good. And so I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, not at all. And so I guess what I'm trying to say in terms of a future is I'd like to see a future where Muslims, along with other people of strong ethical traditions, whether religious, spiritual, moral, philosophical, what have you, contribute to creating the civil, organic, apolitical fabric out of which a rich democratic society is created. It can't be top-down. It has to be bottom-up and side-to-side, that kind of thing. Because that's what really takes... I think that's what democracies require to function well. And if you don't have that, you have either absolute chaos, so you have civil conflict, or you have dictatorship. And I think both are... fundamentally hostile to the human spirit, never mind human flourishing.
Yeah, I love that. Oh my God, that's so great. Before I let you go, I want you to offer three books that you think, in addition to your own 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision for a Muslim Future, what are three books that struck you this year? We've been talking about bumping up against ideas. What are three books that have struck you?
Sure. So one book that I loved was Arthur Brooks's From Strength to Strength. So I'm 42, and this is a book about the second half of life. I don't know if you've read it. I found it really interesting and enjoyable because here's, an obviously very smart man thinking about the second half of life, literally, and what does it mean to prosper and flourish, and what has he learned along the way? And so there's a lot of wisdom there about how we change, or rather should change, and age gracefully and intelligently. And I think really the core idea is that he says that, up until your 30s and maybe your early 40s, maybe... you're very good at assimilating new information. So you're more open to change. You can learn new skills. And starting in our 40s, we develop a different talent, which is to synthesize information. And so he's really saying that you should learn as much as you can. And then that's where wisdom comes from, is that as we get older, through experience, we learn how to combine even novel information. And, he had this great anecdote that he once was at a workshop held by, I think it was Meta or some big company, the former Facebook, and they were lauding their diversity. And he kind of raised his hand and said, there's no one here over 28. And say, you know, maybe you'll have a little bit of a different perspective on the world if you've lived through more of the world. And it was a really good
point. That is so interesting.
I think as we get older, we realize that, you know, we can, now we look at, for example, social media and say, hey, you know, some of that stuff should have been pretty obvious. That maybe, you know, a human being shouldn't have that much information all at once, right? That kind of thing.
Well, as a 58-year-old, I will say that, you know, you just get so wise at my age. Anyway, I just is oozing wisdom, as you can tell. All right, that sounds amazing. That was Arthur
Arabic
Brooks.
Term, sheikh, like a sheikh.
What?
The Arabic term sheikh. Literally,
oh, yes.
I mean, it's usually meant to mean someone who's wise, a learned elder, but literally means someone who has white hair. And so my question is, what happens to someone who has no hair? Is that elevated status that I've achieved?
From now on, please do call me Sheikh Paul because I have white hair
one.
Now.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. Okay, Arthur, say the name one more time.
Arthur Brooks, the author, and the book is called From Strength to Strength.
From Strength to Strength.
It's an easy read. It's a short book. It's a great book.
Yeah.
The second one is also a short one. It's called Wild Problems by Russ Roberts, who was at the University of Chicago, and I believe now is president of a university in Jerusalem. I don't know him personally. I've never met him. I came across his book randomly in the library, and the librarian said, hey, this is a great book. It's a very slim book, and it's just a little book on why we have so much trouble making big decisions. And I would strongly recommend it to anyone who is confronting a major life choice, such as major career choice, marriage, divorce, what have you. It's a really novel take on why big decisions elude us. And it's a really thought-provoking read. So I really liked it. I've recommended it.
That's amazing. Say the name one more time.
So it's called Wild Problems, as in, you know, untamed, wild.
Yeah,
and the author's name is Russ Roberts.
Russ Roberts. Yeah. I think I don't want to hide the fact that you actually went to a library and asked a librarian or listen to a – I mean, thank God for libraries. Thank God for librarians is all I'll say. That's beautiful.
It's great to have people who – and they read and they know books, and it's wonderful.
Amazing. Yes, yes. Good. Okay, what's your last one?
Okay, the third one is a little bit of a fun one. So I don't know how to pronounce the author's name. Her first name is Eric, or her last name is Fatland, F-A-T-L-A-N-D. I appreciate the irony because most people often struggle with my name, but she's Norwegian. So the book is it's called Borderland. It's a big fat book, and it's originally in Norwegian. I of course read the English translation, so I can't comment on the original. But it's quite entertaining and funny, and weirdly prescient because she, being from Norway, was very curious about one of Norway's neighbors, Russia, and I guess one day opened an atlas and realized that Russia borders, I believe, 14 countries, and so she decided to basically travel the border of Russia. And of course, this was before the Ukraine war when now I think that's probably not possible or perhaps a very good idea. But it's a really charming, fun, funny book just about a woman who's really observant, really witty, really clever, really smart, really curious, traveling through societies that some of them she knows about, some of them she doesn't know about. And she has a knack, like great travel writers, for finding the really weird stuff. That somehow
it sounds
really
amazing.
It's a good read.
Borderland.
I think it came out 3 or 4 years ago. I could be wrong, but it's a fun one.
This is supposed to be 2022.
I mean, I'm perpetually behind. I will. Just
okay. All right. All right. Well, we're gonna let it go. But yes. Okay. Haroon Mughal is an author, public speaker, and occasional Friday preacher who works to build a vibrant role for faith in shaping a better future. Haroon's latest book is titled 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision for a Muslim Future. Haroon, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me, Sheikh Paul.